I'm going to be talking into a microphone because we are webcasting this live. And so I want to start out by thanking everybody here in the audience and everybody in cyberspace who's joining us via the webcast. My name is Mark Raimondi. I'm the Director of Communications for Harris Corporation in Washington, D.C. Before we start, I just want to say that our thoughts and prayers are with the victims of yesterday's metro accident and their families, and we wish those injured in that horrible accident speedy recovery. And they're definitely in our thoughts. Today is the second time we're discussing cyber issues. We did an event at the New York City Press Club last month, and we plan on taking this on the road to other cities down the road. For those of you unfamiliar with Harris, we're a Fortune 500 communications and information technology company with government and civilian customers in about 150 countries around the world. We're honored today to have such distinguished guests who could join us to discuss what the Cyber Czar's first 100 days could look like. You have their impressive bios in front of you, so I'm not going to repeat what's in there. Those of you attending the webcast, those bios are also available on the webcast page. Alphabetically, I'd like to introduce Mr. James Bamford, Mr. Tom Davis, former Congressman of Virginia, and General Dale Myros. Mr. Bamford is one of the most accomplished and respected journalists on cyber-related topics. He's the author of several books about the NSA, all of which were on the New York Times bestseller list. And we're very pleased you could fly in from London to join us today. Mr. Davis, seven-term congressman from Virginia's 11th district. He's now with Deloitte as the director of federal government affairs. He has a reputation when he was on the Hill as a skilled legislator who took on some of the most difficult issues. And he was the key driver. What is causing that? Sorry. He's the key driver of the Federal Information and Security Act of 2002, requiring federal agencies to address cyber risks. And finally, General Myros has 4 decades of federal service, including time as the first Senate-confirmed chief information officer for the U.S. intelligence community. He's a retired Air Force Major General who, while in service, was responsible for some of the Defense Department's most critical networks. And Air Force Academy grad, and he's the current vice president and general manager for Harris Corporation for Cyber and Information Security. And with that said, Mr. Davis has a plane to catch, so we're going to let him go first. The format will be several minutes of an intro from the legislative, executive branch, and media section, and then we'll open it up to questions. Please wait until the microphone reaches you before you ask a question. Thank you.
Well, thanks. Well, the good news is whoever the new cyber czar is won't have to be Senate confirmed. So once they get named, they don't have to worry about whether they paid their taxes or not. They can get on the ground and move immediately. The real question is how much authority are they going to have? You have a lot of czars up there, a lot of competing interests within the government. What is your ability to deal with all of these stovepipes that have been set up? I mean, every agency head likes to innovate in their own way. They want to put down their footprint, leave their own legacy. Those are very hard to dislodge, but that can be done within the executive branch framework if the president backs them up through OMB circulars, through executive orders, in some cases regulations. What we need to understand is there's going to be legislative initiatives, too, to accomplish what needs to be accomplished. It's going to take legislation from Congress, and if you think it's difficult solving it within the bureaucracy, you know, wait till you get to Congress, because jurisdiction drives the place. I know, of course, I was a full committee chairman in the House. I understand how jurisdiction works. It's a patchwork quilt of jurisdictional overlays, and when you get to the cyber wars, it gets even more complex because every committee claims some semblance of jurisdiction on this. We were able to move through FISMA through our committee, kind of snuck it through at the point and kept it, wrote the law in such a way that it would stay under our committee's jurisdiction. Other areas wouldn't get a bite of it. I'm afraid, given the complexities of where we are today, you're going to have a number of committees who are going to want a piece of this legislation, whether it relates to privacy, it could relate to FOIA, it could really, you know, because a lot of the critical infrastructure is privately owned, gets it into the ambit of the Commerce, Energy and Commerce Committee. the Science Committee through the National Science Foundation groups is going to want to have a say over grants and how government portions this out. As I said, the government committee oversees all federal reorganizations. They'll want a good piece of that. The Commerce Committee, as I noted before, is going to want to – they claim anything with an HR in front of it in the House. The Armed Services Committee is clearly going to be front and forward. They've sent it, they had a lot of hearings on this issue before. They think this should be under their ambit, but they run against Homeland Security, who thinks this should be their ambit. And they're going to claim a piece of this legislation and write it. And then you get the intelligence committees in the act and say, oh, no, this is high level. This is intelligence. It ought to be us. And, of course, none of them have any say without the appropriators. The appropriators come in here. Without money, it's hard to get much done. Even now, one of the greatest failings of FISMA was the incongruity you had between the authorizers and the FISMA reports that would come out and appropriations. There was really no incentive from an appropriations point of view to make some of the changes that need to be made. That would exist as this new cyber czar and the administration approach trying to fix this problem. Then you get the financial services committees and the template that they've laid down, because a lot of the innovation that's gone on in cybersecurity has come from financial services industries and how they work through. And finally, you get to the Judiciary Committee. You can't get to the Freedom of Information Act. You can't get to tort reform, the kind of things you need to share information in the private sector without going through judiciary, which is basically owned by the trial lawyers. And so it becomes a very, very complex. Now, one thing I would note in this town is if there's a crisis, things can move pretty quickly. I think we've seen that with the stimulus package. We saw this after the 9/11 Commission reported. Sometimes gridlock can be broken very quickly when an administration decides to do it or when there is a perceived crisis, and everybody can get together pretty quickly and crack the whip. The difficulty right now is that there are so many things going on in Washington, so many crises and aspects of that crisis, it makes it very hard to kind of ferret what is the priority of this with everything else going on. So I hope I've just given you a glimpse into some of the complexities that the administration faces. I applaud them for making this a priority, though, giving it a lot of attention. They're talking to quality people as you move around into some of these critical positions, and I wish them luck.
As a journalist, I'm sort of paid to be cynical, so I'll be very cynical here. When this was announced, when the president announced that he said the White House cyber security coordinator would have regular access, quotes, regular access to me. But the problem is, by placing somebody that's pretty far down the totem pole in the bureaucracy, basically placing somebody under two committees. One is the National Security Council, and the other is the Economic Council. You have somebody that's down there. I don't know a real powerful person that would actually take a job that would be kind of that low in the bureaucracy, where you're not only reporting to one committee but another. But the idea of trying to get a paper that you're writing through one committee and then the other committee and then making all the changes and having to go through those committees again before you even get to the chief of staff of the president, I just don't see how the person is going to have regular access to the president or have very much of a voice if you're that low in the totem pole. Plus, usually the power flows wherever the money flows from, and here I don't see any budget control over the over anything dealing with cyber. It's basically just recommendation, and the president said that you know, if there's a crisis, the person will work in the White House as the crisis coordinator, which I could see. But on a day-to-day basis, it just doesn't seem like the person's going to have much power over the position. Having covered NSA for most of my life, NSA plays a big role here, since that will be the 800-pound gorilla to some degree, since there's an addition to a discussion of White House coordinator for cyber. There's also this discussion of a cyber command, and the cyber command is it's been pretty much laid out so far. Looks like the director of NSA will run the cyber command, or else they'll create a new cyber command attached to NSA and take the current director of NSA and put him in charge. So whatever way you're looking at it, the NSA will be largely in charge of the cyber command, although there'll probably be a dotted line to the strategic command in Omaha. I mean, the problem with that is that you're taking this enormous agency that at least in my viewpoint, abused the trust for a long time after 9/11 when it conducted warrantless eavesdropping, and then giving them a very large role, a very powerful role in the whole issue of domestic cyber information. Because once information comes into the United States or goes through the United States, the NSA plays a role. That came out very clearly after during the warrantless eavesdropping period, where the NSA began building an infrastructure within AT&T in San Francisco and other places. The problem is having deep packet inspection by NSA into not just foreign communications, but domestic communications now. The president said that there would be, I think I've got a quote here. He said that there'd be no role, domestic role for this, but I don't understand how there could be no domestic role if you're talking about cyber information going into and out of and through the United States. So what you have here is you have a very powerful player in the cyber domain, and that'll be the director of NSA, a fairly weak player, and that'll be the White House cyber coordinator. So that poses a lot of, at least from a press perspective or a perspective of somebody who follows these things, it presents quite a dilemma in terms of public civil liberties and so forth. I'd be much happier if they put a very powerful person in charge of all the cyber activity so that the director of NSA or the director, rather, of the cyber command reported to that person as well as people in the rest of the U.S. government bureaucracy, and then have a deputy who probably comes from the civil liberties side of the spectrum, from EPIC or electronic information privacy or the electronic privacy foundation and so forth. These groups that follow the cyber war and also follow the civil liberties side of that. So, I mean, the press is going to have lots of questions about this when I think 100 days is up, how much influence does NSA have and so forth. I think that's going to be a key question. What the president said was that he would bar the federal government from regular monitoring of, quote, private sector networks. And I don't really see how that's possible since the NSA is already monitoring private sector networks. Finally, just one other, sort of be the skunk in the parade here. I think there's a lot of hype that goes into this issue. It's so easy. I've been doing this for years, writing about cyber stuff and NSA and wars and everything. And you can hype it so much. It's so easy to get a lead story on the news if you put terrorism or cyber or something sexy in there. It's much harder to get something on the war on cancer or, the war on drunk driving, something like that, that really do kill a lot of people. So I worry a bit about the hype factor here because we've hyped the war on terrorism, insanely. We've hyped the war on drugs, hyped the war on Iraq, hyped this new war in Afghanistan now, all these dangers. The world's coming to an end if we don't do something. And I just would like to see it toned down a little bit more on the danger factors. Obviously, there's a danger, but as far as I know, nobody's penetrated the classified systems of the U.S. government yet. Nobody's been killed. There's always a danger of that. But again, I just worry a little bit about the being the cynic here. Worry a little bit about the hype factor. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. I would like to add a little bit different perspective from my colleagues. I'd like to start out by saying that so many of the issues surrounding cyber are the exact same issues that surround our other national discussions, whether it's about banking, manufacturing, the recession or the thought of the recession or whatever. I don't believe at the macro level that there's anything fundamentally different. So when it comes to cyber, what's the proper role of government? What participation and responsibilities or accountability does industry have, particularly as Congressman Davis pointed out, 85% of the critical infrastructure in this country is in private ownership. And lastly, what accountability does our citizenry have? And I don't believe that across the board our citizenry understands that they should have an accountability with regard to this. And so when you look at it from that perspective, from a cultural level, from a political level, the things that underpin the topic of cyber, I think, are fundamentally no different than many of the other issues that are confronting us. One of the things that tends to be a distractor from my point of view is that folks get all hung up on what's the definition of cyber. And to some degree, I don't think it matters. Matter of fact, to a large degree, I don't think it matters. But if you look at cyber as a domain and a language that affixes itself to a level of technology and social networking and things like that, it's a little easier to understand. 20 years ago, we talked about local area networks, wide area networks, and we talk about systems and enterprises and so we, you know, people no longer get scared when somebody says megabits or a technical term and viruses, and we've all learned to understand some of the technical language. But what's different today, and why cyber has become a news buzzword, is technology and how we use it is fundamentally changed with not only within our country but around the world. And how we think of it, and its interconnectedness, and how it things are made dependent, and those kinds of things. And so the danger becomes we have a lot of familiar terms, but unfamiliar paradigms associated with those old terms. And so I think that sometimes ends up being a distractor. The next distractor is that culturally, both as the congressman pointed out and Mr. Bamford, is that there's a blurring of what we accept, what we understand, and what's gone before. And what I really mean by this blurring is cyber is global. It has no borders. And so what is domestic versus what is foreign? And so all of our legislation, all of our processes, all of our analysis, if you will, of things, you know, that they're lacking. Again, they may have common terms, but the paradigm, you know, somebody shifted the paradigms. Foreign and domestic, military, civilian, and such. I think the coordinator has got three fundamental issues. The first is, as has been pointed out by my colleagues, work on the authorities. The second is that when you add a new position anywhere, particularly in the executive branch, there has to be an accommodation of process. You have to get it in the information flow. You have to be, you know, invited to meetings. You have to be a part, and so there's an element in which you have to create process, and other processes need to accommodate you. And then third of all, you need an agenda, something that works a priority. I think the most encouraging thing about the president's statements and the release of the 60-day report is that the status quo is unacceptable. That came out loud and clear in the report. That came out loud and clear in the president's press conference about it. The report has 45 major implied tasks in about four categories of education, securing networks, relationships, and harmonizing and synchronizing efforts. You can't have 45 priority ones. You need to provide that focus and get the agenda which moves things forward.
All right, we're going to start out with a question that was emailed from Laura Strickler, who's a CBS Evening News producer, who is on her way here and got reprogrammed for other news. The question is to General Myros and Mr. Davis. Given the increasing automation of things like metro trains, planes, etc., does it make us more vulnerable to cyber attacks, and can these things be prevented?
Well, I mean, I'll start. Absolutely, we're more vulnerable to cyber attacks than any time in history, and I think the whole purpose is to try to stay ahead of the curve before you get some kind of cyber Pearl Harbor, the term that's generally used, but we want to stay ahead of that curve before something gets into something that's top secret and can do a lot of damage. We've seen so many penetrations now. When politicians see it on their computers in their offices, when they're seeing it going into their websites for their campaigns, then it hits home. But it could get into a critical infrastructure and do everything from, you know, the airplanes, trains, the public, the electronic grid. There's a lot of vulnerabilities out there today. Some of them we haven't even thought about, and we're trying to stay ahead of the curve.
From my perspective, anything that's connected is vulnerable and at risk. Second of all, what a lot of folks don't realize is everything that gives you a capability or a functionality in cyberspace represents an attack thread that somebody can come back and use against you. The last thing I would say is that there is a concept that when we talk about cyber or we talk about computer penetrations and networks, then people think that's network, that's something that doesn't touch me. And in fact, cyber, anything that touches cyberspace is a part of this. So it's not just computers. You know, it's your ATM card and the ATM. It is your ability to turn a light on and off in your house. And so, again, I would encourage folks to not narrow their perspective of when they hear about computer networks at risk, thinking that, well, all I've got is I've got my own computer. It's not connected to a network. I just plug into the Internet. They're not talking about me. If it's connected, it's vulnerable. If you're able to do something, that's an attack thread. And there are all kinds of appliances that are propelled by cyber.
Please identify yourself from this question.
Hi, I'm Josiah Ryan with CNS News. Mr. Bamford, you painted a pretty cynical picture of what its position is, something like a straw man. I'm wondering if you can talk about what the political motivations behind creating such a powerless position would be. And I'm wondering if General Myros and Congressman Davis would agree with the picture that Mr. Bamford painted.
What was the – you just repeat the first part of your question there.
You painted the kind of a powerless position within the White House, and I'm wondering if you can talk about some of the politics behind it. What is the motivation for the administration creating this position if there's really no power behind it?
Well, I mean, just looking at the position on a piece of paper, you can see it's very low down the totem pole. I think the idea of creating the position is a great idea, and I think President Obama talked about it a great deal before during the election and before he was elected. I just think there was at least in a number of the circles I hang around in, there was a bit of a disappointment after the talk that the position didn't have the stature that it might have had. I think somebody from a former congressperson would be a good person to have the job because you have to deal a lot with Congress. I don't think you have to be a real techie to do it. I think you need some stature. You have to be somebody that's powerful, somebody that can break through the bureaucracy and get to the president and tell him you've got to do this. Forget what these people are saying. You've got to do this. And I don't see that at this level, this person. I don't know who would take that position if you're powerful. You're not going to take a sort of a junior staffer position. The politics of why it happened, I have no idea. It just there's a lot of things about the Obama administration that haven't made sense to me in terms of why they've done things, and this is just one more thing. They said, you know, they were going to take different policies on secrecy, on a lot of other issues, and then they changed their mind after the election. So maybe they changed their mind, and they didn't want a really powerful position. The problem is there is going to be a vacuum there, and there is going to be a very powerful cyber person, and that's going to be the director of the cyber command. So you should have some counterbalance there in the White House to say, well, I think they're going a little too far there, and that's why I think it should be more powerful. But I don't really know why they did that.
I take a little bit different view. After over 3.5 decades in the federal government, I know that major things sometimes take small steps to get started. I have a phrase that I developed over time that helped me accomplish what things I was managed to accomplish in government. Think big, start small, scale fast. And so I think almost by necessity ends up being a small step. Does it fall short of what some folks would want to press harder and faster, saying there's not enough time, we're falling behind, and all those kinds of things? I mean, there's merit to that discussion. But major things almost by necessity, if they're not in response to an emergency, by nature, start small. The key is their top cover. I've advocated ever since the administration announced the 60-day review that I thought a person of prominent name recognition ought to be in this, because it's not only working within government, but it's being able to get access in industry and be a household name with the American public.
Now, there are so many czars in this administration. You don't know at the end of the day what are the real priorities. If you make everything a priority, nothing becomes a priority sometimes. So I'm not cynical about it, but I think we need to understand that this, when was just described earlier, this is a very complicated, difficult task. If nothing else, you get to deflect blame if you're on top and you have a czar and something happens. After 9/11, instead of blaming the terrorists, I think sometimes we looked at each other and pointed fingers at each other and said, was this Clinton's fault? Was this Bush's fault? What did they know? What did they let go through? That's the politics of this. And I think at a minimum, the administration wants to be on top, because this has been neglected for a long time by administrations from both parties that have really failed to put together, in my judgment, the appropriate leadership. We'll see where it goes. As I said before, I applaud them for identifying this as a key issue, trying to put one person in charge, but it's a very difficult, complicated task.
Max Kakis from Federal News Radio. I want to put Mr. Davis on the spot here a little bit. Your name's been bandied about as possible candidate for this job, Mr. Davis. Are you interested? And for the panel, if it's not Tom Davis, what kind of characteristics would you be looking for in someone who could pull off this job, given what Mr. Bamford has just described for us, and what kind of a person would be ideal for it?
You know, Max, I think if I'd wanted to stay in government, I would have stayed in Congress. I think I just need a hiatus at this point. I mean, you never say never on something like this. You want to part of his service with me. But I've just – I was 29 years in office, my best earning years. And as I said, when I left, it's a sabbatical. It's not permanent. But at this point, I don't have any real interest in going back. I was lucky enough to leave Congress undefeated and unindicted. And sometimes it's good to leave on top.
When I talk about someone with name recognition, I'm not necessarily thinking about a technologist, maybe a manager of technology, but not a technologist. And even if you do get someone, there are not many people within government that are noted in this particular area, well known, if you will, unless it might be a few folks in uniform. You have to marry up a team with that person. And so if they're a name recognition force that can get entrees into boardrooms, into other parts of the cabinets, be taken seriously by Congress, you have to back that person up with a team that understands how to make things work in government. And I can't tell you the number of times that we've had the right person but not the right team working issues. And it's a combination. There's a pragmatic nature and understanding that you have to have about a government. Understanding the difference between appropriations committees and authorization committees is hugely important when you're trying to get things done. Understanding how to be successful in the interagency process, and so it takes somebody that understands that top to bottom and how to work those things. And so I don't think it's necessarily the right – it's not only just the right person. You've got to surround that person with the right team. If, on the other hand, you pick someone who's got a lot of bureaucratic skills as being the top person, you need to surround or bolster that person with name recognition, other prominent support, and those kinds of things. So I think it's the correct question is how do you build the right team, not how do you find the right individual.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I don't really have a formula or a name in mind for who should do it. I just think it should be somebody that commands the president's respect and could get his attention when he needs to get it, and also can tell head of NSA or four-star general, I don't think that's a good idea, and I don't think you should do it. So it should be somebody like that. Again, I think somebody that has to work with Congress a lot. That's why I've thought of somebody from Congress possibly, or somebody that just has a lot of stature that can command this issue. They don't have to know exactly how which electron goes which way or whatever, but they have to know policy and how to work that policy through an administration.
Dan Fowler from Congressional Quarterly. This is sort of a follow-up question on Max's question for Mr. Davis. There was a Time article that came out, I think, last week, which said that you were a leading candidate for this cyber coordinator or cyber czar position. So just to be clear at this point, that you're not a candidate for this position. Is that?
I'm not a candidate for anything. I'm just trying to be a citizen. As I said, you never say never to help your country. This is it. But for this job to work, I mean, you'd better get some understandings up front if you're the cyber czar and you want to have any clout in this. And at this point, it's unclear to me what the position would even entail, how much authority you would have. Everybody likes to tackle problems. I've tackled tough problems. I did the District of Columbia when I took that committee, the least sought-after committee assignment in the House, and passed the Control Board Act. I took the campaign committee at a tough time when the party was so you always look, but for this at this point, it's unclear. I am not seeking to get back into government. I like the job I have. I like being able to be a freelance commentator. I love speculation. It's always helpful for the branding. But you never say never. There's always a part of service, I think, in all of us at this point. But I'm doing very well right now without looking to do anything else.
Can I just ask one follow-up question on that? Have you been interviewed for the position?
You know what? I don't want to. That's a evasive question. I didn't understand it. The answer is I'm not seeking it at this point, and I don't know where they are along the lines of this one. So.
General Myros, Scott Willis from PBS Nova. You talked about familiar terms and unfamiliar paradigms: civilian versus military, domestic versus foreign. Is there also a shift there in terms of offensive versus defensive, and can you, in cyber warfare, there's a lot of offensive opportunity, I'm sure, and can you separate that offensive opportunity from the role of a cyber czar, and doesn't that really complicate the whole process of
sure.
What they have?
I take a little bit different view than most folks on this. See, the terms offensive and defensive, I was a part of this figuring out what those were. And, those came from the military side of the house. And offensive implies there's an aggression or an objective to capture, and defensive implies that there's a resistance or a protection. And those were terms that were probably apropos when we started. But those are also, I think, shifting paradigms. I am one that very much believes that there's almost no such thing as offensive and defensive, because a lot of cyber activity can be interference without intent. It's what's your intent. And so things can be disruptive, things can become vulnerable and all those kinds of things when the intent is not necessarily to seek and destroy or to shield and ward off. I think it's more important of can you detect when something has happened, and when what are you going to do about it if it produces unfavorable outcomes? And I think that framework is more constructive in the terms of cyber talk. There is cyber war. There are folks who intend to attack the United States or attack individuals. If they attack the United States, we tend to think of them that's war. If they're criminals and they're going after individuals to try and take money and things like that, we tend to think that. But the activities are the same. And when we were creating the terms offense and defense back in the late 90s and early 2000, we were having people saying, well, if you put up a shield that repelled, then that was an offensive act. And we actually, you know, we debated that. I mean, that was a debate. And so it was like every single element of, if you fixed a vulnerability, that was could be an offensive act because that vulnerability reached out beyond your network. And so I think one of the natural things that's going to happen in this cyber discussion over the next couple of years, we're going to look at offensive and defensive differently, and it's going to be desirable, undesirable outcomes, things that you do that affect others in cyberspace, things that they do that affect you. The thing that intent is going to be the most in cyberspace is that those who have an intent to do something that's not constructive are going to be trying to be as stealthy as possible. So stealth will be one of those things that will replace the idea of offense and defense.
Ben Bain with Federal Computer Week. Question for Mr. Davis, but I guess probably to the whole panel. One of the things the administration said is they want to make cybersecurity one of their management priorities. So they really want to hold agencies, in theory, accountable for how secure their networks are. I was wondering from your perspective with how FISMA was implemented by the last administration, if you could maybe comment on what you would think that the administration would need to do, this new coordinator might need to do to make that a reality. And a second part of that, there's also a lot of changes, proposed changes to FISMA floating out there. Anything you've seen that you think is a good idea, a bad idea?
Yeah. Well, thanks. No, it's a good question. First of all, I think the administration has a lot of leeway just with OMB to start enforcing this and making it a priority. One of the difficulties with FISMA is you put these new reporting requirements on, but there was no teeth to it, and there was no additional funding for it. And for these poor agency directors down there, you're giving them just a new priority with no money. They have to accomplish their mission. Many times they would defer this, and it was kind of a check-the-box mentality. Now, I think it did help the systems over time. I don't get me wrong. But I think we're ready now to take the next step. I think you've got to stay vendor neutral. There are a lot of things we have to do. One other thing Dale and I were talking about prior to this is right now we're not even secure with the government computers when people leave government now. They're walking off with their computers. Just very basic protocols aren't being implemented throughout government. Even without a cyber czar, I think there's a lot that could be done through OMB that has not been done in the past on this. So a new cyber czar, the whole point is I'm just not clear what the authorities are going to be and how much backing they're going to get from the White House at this point, given some of the entrenched bureaucracies they're going to have to deal with. And I think that the resistance that they'll get along the line, it's a tough, tough job for somebody. I think whoever looks at it is going to have to try to get some understandings up front that they're going to be able to make a difference and not just be another bureaucrat.
As probably the only person in this room who's ever been subject to FISMA and actually filed FISMA reports with Congress, I had one view when I was doing it, and I've got another view that I'm sitting next to Congressman Davis. No, that's not true. Remember when I said earlier about you think big, you start small, and you scale fast. And he knows better than probably anyone in this room the art of legislation and lawmaking is sometimes more of an art and a science. And so in retrospect, as one who, except for the last two quarters, filled out every FISMA quarterly report and annual report to Congress since the inception of the law, it was a good first step. It was probably in the only form that it could get passed, and I think as a good first step, it had desired outcomes. But with everything, now's probably a time, maybe a little past time. It's time to add more teeth, as Congressman Davis talked about, add funding and other things to make it worthwhile.
Well, I've never filled out a FISMA report, so I won't make any comment on it. But just one comment on the earlier question about offensive and defensive. What worries me sometimes, having followed these issues for quite a while, is how easily we could slip into a very, very serious and a very dangerous situation by going on the offensive in terms of a cyber war. Using the whole idea of preemptive cyber wars. I mean, we've used preemptive wars to get us into trouble in Iraq. And I've heard talk about the benefits of using preemptive cyber war. Suppose somebody had the great idea a few weeks ago to use a preemptive or use some cyber war to change a few things in Iran with regard to the election. Think how much of a disaster that would be if it was discovered. So I think there's got to be a lot of checks and balances over what we're doing in terms of the offensive side of the whole cyber war.
Stu Magnuson with National Defense Magazine. Keeping on the cyber offense topic, there was a briefing, National Science Foundation report that was in this very room about a month ago, and two of their main points was one, that this discussion has been in the shadows and needs to be more of a public discussion, and on these possible unintended consequences that Mr. Bamford mentioned, and also that it wasn't well understood, these unintentional consequences. And I'd like to hear Mr. Myros, as a former insider, you did mention that there were debates going on as early as the 1990s. So do you think that criticism is fair, and do you think it's a topic that needs to be out in the open more?
Very much so. I am one for believing that we need to be a lot more public on this. But it's two different ways, if you want to think about it. You brought up the military part. And, again, military vulnerabilities are often classified because we don't want to give enemies or potential enemies ideas about how to successfully attack us at the seams. And so any type of vulnerability, whether it's a vulnerability of a weapon system or it's a vulnerability in cyberspace, the tendency within the intelligence community and the Department of Defense is going to be, we need to classify it because we don't want this to become public so that we're more at risk than we currently are. By the same token, in private industry, most companies are not anxious for either shareholders, customers, potential shareholders or potential customers to hear lurid tales of losing personal data or ruined supply chains or untrustworthy transactions or those kinds of things. It affects share price, it affects shareholder confidence, it affects consumer confidence and things like that. We need to figure out how to provide mechanisms which don't make us more vulnerable or don't have those bad side effects for companies in such a way that there might be a cutout or there might be a third party that ends up helping to broke solutions or whatever. I remember some of the early attacks back in the mid 1990s, and I would get calls from colleagues in industry, and I got told very quickly that, you know, you're in the government, and oh, by the way, you're wearing a uniform, and you playing in this and giving them advice about how to deal with network vulnerabilities and break-ins and things like that is totally inappropriate. So we, you know, again, part of that is legislation, and part of that is finding the right common denominator that gets the desired outcome and right behavior.
Yeah, I think the Obama administration should be complimented because they are being far more open than the Bush administration was on this. But when it comes, and that's in terms of some of the thinking and some of the decisions going into this White House cyber coordinator. But when it comes to the actual cyber command, the word that's been coming out of the White House, that's just going to be kept as secret as it was during the Bush administration. And there's, you know, reason for keeping a lot of it secret. It's just that there are dangers out there, and whoever does become a cyber coordinator should be somebody that oversees both the offensive and defensive side, I think, because they're one in the same. They're basically one and the same, and the president needs a powerful voice. The president's doing lots of other things. He needs somebody that can keep track of both of them rather than just somebody that's coordinating domestic cyber issues and then have the military and the NSA and so forth do the external cyber.
Adam Weishaupt from Southern Virginia Security. Mr. Myers, I was wondering if you could address the supply chain vulnerability. You've got Harris Corp has, what, 90 countries?
And, yes, we're a global company,
right?
And the number of countries changes on a week by week basis. See, I think that's an excellent question because it starts us at a better discussion in most of this area. Because a lot of folks immediately want to talk cybersecurity. Cybersecurity, and if you start there as a discussion, as a reactive element, you know, did I get penetrated? Did you know? And I look at that as you go to the state fair and it's a whack-a-mo, those wooden squirrel sticks his head up and you whack it, so now you don't see it, but he's not gone, kind of thing. And a lot of how vulnerable you are at the end is how good you are at building the network in the first place. And we at Harris work very hard at building good networks so that the outcome is you're not in the reactive mode. And you do that with managing the supply chain, both of software, hardware, and middleware, because you can introduce things that you cannot overcome at the back end by not doing the right things at the front end, and so the right kind of systems engineering, the right kind of analysis, the business about making the right risk management decision trade-offs early in either the fielding or the running of the system. Probably has more impact on the long range, how safe, how secure, how effective, how efficient, how manageable are you, than trying to add on security at the end of the process as a bolt-on.
Mr. Bamford, do you think they'll bring John Poindexter back to have a show on Fox with Ali North called Cyber War Stories?
I may actually tune in on something like that. I've been trying to hear... John Poindexter answered some questions for a long time, so that might be pretty good. He keeps turning up, you know. I mean, he's got so many lives, so who knows? Interesting question, though.
Hello? This is Ellen Nakashima with the Washington Post. Question for Mr. Bamford and General Myerose. Jim, you noted that President Obama said he would bar monitoring of the private sector networks, but that you don't see how that's possible when the NSA is already monitoring private sector networks. That raises the issue of what is the most effective way to defend the private sector networks and what ought to be the role of the NSA and perhaps the DOD, DHS, in doing so. Could both you and Mr. Myerose address that, please?
Yeah, I've thought about that numerous times, and I haven't really come to an answer myself. I mean, the argument that NSA makes, which is a valid argument, is that they've got the tools, they've got the personnel. I mean, they've got it all. It's true. I've been very favorable to NSA at times. They had a book signing for me on my earlier book, and I've been very critical about them at times when they were doing the warrantless eavesdropping. So, I'm not sure. I'd like to have NSA play a major role in it, but the problem is the lack of oversight. We didn't know. It was only the New York Times that found out about the warrantless eavesdropping. It certainly wasn't Congress. So I mean, just from my own viewpoint, I could see NSA playing a role in it, but I'd like to have a lot more oversight. You know, like I said, have a very powerful cyber person with a deputy who has a history of civil liberties in the cyber field that would have access also to see that something bad isn't being done. But it's a very bad, very big dilemma because what you're dealing with is a world without borders. Phone call from London to Tokyo will go right through the U.S., and for a millisecond it's a domestic call, but it's also basically a foreign communication, so it's extremely difficult, and I don't really – luckily I don't have to have those answers. I just have to ask the questions. But it is a very good question. I appreciate it.
It is indeed, and this gets back to my blurring comment earlier. As most of you know who follow this, this was brought out – in a big way early last summer with the passage of the new FISA law, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And while that took care of a set of elements that were, you know, that had come to the forefront that needed to be fixed, that needed to be worked on, it didn't address the larger elements about what the role of government in general, which is something that we need to come to grips with as a society, legislatively, culturally, and technically. And then once you come that, then it's military and civilian. What's the proper agency? It is my contention that I think the administration is doing the initial right step of trying to put established leadership from the White House on this subject. But like in the thinking big, starting small, scaling fast, that's a starting small piece. Just like FISA would be a starting small piece in addressing the elements of the role of NSA or the role of government, et cetera. 18 months from now, you know, there probably needs to be something more substantial, or it needs to lead to something, or 2 months or 24 months from now or whatever. Just establishing leadership in the White House is a necessary first step, but it's not the end game. And so does there need to be a Department of Cyber? Or better yet, has cyber so fundamentally changed our culture and the nature of how we can rule, legislate ourselves, that we need another Hoover Commission or Hoover-like commission to reorganize the entire executive branch? Now, I'm not a fan of commissions. I've been the subject of several, and I've even been on a couple, and those were not all that satisfying either. But the idea is that in the middle of the 20th century, it became obvious that the agrarian setup of particularly the executive arm of government was no longer able to deal with the industrial jet age governing of the country. And so, you know, has cyber fundamentally changed that we need another Hoover-like commission? And if not, when will that happen? And when we go past the elbow on the curve, how long will it take us to realize that, oh, we should have done that last year or the year before?
I wanted to re-ask my question because I was asking more about the offense. The NSF report I mentioned was more about within the government that they didn't believe it was being talked about or well understood, the unintended consequences of, for example, the Air Force doing a cyber attack on an enemy or so on. And like I said, you suggested that there were some discussions on that very early.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, there have been discussions on it continually. The Air Force has stepped out, as have the other services, very prominently. And when you hear leaders in the Air Force talk, they talk about global reach, global power. They talk about airspace and cyberspace as part of their mantra. And if you peeled back the rhetoric from the other services, you would find that cyber plays a very prominent role in the digitization of today's army, in the business of command and control from the sea, and all of those kinds of things. So this is I was trying to point out that the discussion has been around for a long time, and just like if we're creating tactics that we think can inflict damage on an enemy or potential enemy, giving that up as an advantage is probably not an advisable thing to do. So there is a need for security in the classical sense of security of all of those other kinds of things. But as Mr. Bamford stated, offense and defense are two sides of the same coin. You know, it's the same skills, the same actions, the same. See, here's something that's hard for us to get our hands around, and that is that in cyber, I'm a user, I'm a customer, I'm a threat, I'm a target, I'm a defender, and I'm part of the infrastructure all at the same time. Okay, so having a concept that says that I, an individual private citizen, can in fact be a target or a threat is something that again speaks to how we need to educate our populace about what cyber is, what it means to us as a country, how it underpins virtually every part of our lives, and that it's important that we prod our government to provide the right leadership, and we help define what that role in leadership is.
And just to add one point to the argument here was on the offensive and defensive, just a few months ago, or less than 2 months ago, the person who was head of cyber security or the cyber security area for the Homeland Security, Office of Homeland, Department of Homeland Security, quit in protest because he felt that the NSA was getting too much, being too dominant in the field, and they weren't paying enough attention to the Homeland Security side of it. So it is, this debate is very prominent within government, who's going to have the say and who's going to be more powerful. And here you have one person that quit saying that NSA is the 800-pound gorilla here, and I can't do my job because they're getting too much money and too much power and too much authority.
See, where we may be at the crossroads, and again, the president talked about being at a crossroads, is that cyber may have become an element of national power on par with diplomatic, military, and economic, but we've not recognized or accepted that as fact yet.
All right. That's all the time we have for today. I want to thank our panel. I want to thank our audience here. I also want to thank our audience in cyberspace who tuned into the webcast. The webcast will be available for replay. You can visit the Harris website to find out how at www.harris.com. And anybody out there on the webcast can also send questions that we will get out to our panel. Send it to mdyson@harris.com. Again, that's mdyson@harris.com. I'd like to thank our public affairs associate, Morgan Dyson, for putting a lot of this together. And look forward to seeing a lot of you at the next event.